You know how I say all the time jobs are the whole smash in this economy? I mean, they still are, but also inflation, hello? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risnall. Tuesday, today, April the 12th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to begin today. We are going to continue today, and we are going to end today, yes, with inflation. And if that comes as a shock, well, have you seen the numbers? I mean, of course you have. The consumer price index was up 1.2% February to March, 8.5% from a year ago. That is a lot, I think, is the macroeconomic term. The reasons why we have covered also a lot. But look, the Federal Reserve has made inflation its number one priority. We know that because they tell us all the time. So surely, with all the interest rate hikes that are coming, relief is just around the corner, right? Right? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Welcome to my shower.
Thank God this is radio and not TV.
We are here because this is where Harvard economist and former Treasury Secretary under Clinton, Larry Summers, says you can see the challenge of controlling inflation.
We've all had the experience of being in a shower where there's a 20-second lag between the time you turn the faucet and the time the temperature of the water changes. And it's really hard not to scald yourself or freeze yourself.
Yeah, it's still cold over here. The Fed raises interest rates to control inflation, but it takes anywhere from 9 months to 2 years for it to actually have an effect. So it's hard to know. Are you not doing enough and letting inflation get away? Or are you doing too much and sending the economy into a recession? Now, just to back up for a second, there are a couple reasons why it takes so long to see results from inflation policy.
The first is that most people don't pay that much attention to interest rates. They don't pay that much attention to the Federal Reserve.
Laura Veldkamp is an economist at Columbia.
And because we're unaware, we don't change how we behave.
Not until we start to notice things in our daily lives affected by rising interest rates. Mortgage rates are really high, or my credit card bill is extra high. And then it takes time for our reactions to filter through the economy. We buy fewer homes, we buy less stuff, companies start holding down prices, the housing market calms down. All of that takes a while, which means
we'll probably see some still very elevated inflation over much of the remainder of this year.
Alan Dettmeister is an economist at UBS and used to work at the Fed. Here is the wrinkle. Some of what is causing inflation has nothing to do with the Fed or its interest rates. Things like the war in Ukraine, lockdowns in China, supply chain problems.
So the Fed's main tool of interest rate increases, which generally affect aggregate demand, is not well suited for the current inflation.
But it has to try, because who knows what's going to happen with the war and supply chains in China. Marcus Brunnermeier is an economist at Princeton.
Of course, there is hope that, you know, the energy prices might stabilize again. Perhaps a war in Ukraine will slow down, but these are only hopes.
But of course, he says, you can't base policy on hope alone. And there's no saying something else won't come up, which bumps up inflation again. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
I said we're going to continue with inflation because inflation, and here is Exhibit A, breakfast cereal prices up 9% year on year, coffee up 11%, bacon up 18%, oranges, beef, chicken, milk. I could go on, but I won't. Instead, just two words, bulk buying. Here's Matt Levin.
Jessica Sanchez never considered herself a Costco person, but now every time she opens her refrigerator, she gets a reminder that her shopping identity is evolving.
And now I have like six bottles of kombucha in my fridge that I still haven't drank.
Sanchez used to shop mostly at regular supermarkets with her two kids in tow.
It's tough. And when it's like an extra $100 a week that you're spending on groceries.
Expecting that to continue, Sanchez bought a Costco membership in January and started buying some things in bulk. That's how basic economic theory says consumers should act in times like these, says Scott Baker at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management.
They basically want to bring those purchases forward to the present when prices are lower, versus waiting to purchase those goods in the future when they think prices are going to be much higher.
That's more good news for Costco, which already benefited from pandemic stockpiling, says Arun Sundaram at the investment research firm CFRA.
Over the past 2 years, about a 13% increase in their membership rates. And when they gain new members, they tend to stay.
He says the pandemic has also loosened a key bulk buying constraint for many families.
A lot of people we saw move from more urban environments to the suburbs. You know, that in turn allows you to have more storage space.
But even if you have room in the new garage, you probably don't want to store eggs and milk in there. Though she buys less at the regular supermarket than she used to, Jessica Sanchez still shops there for more perishable items. And there's another benefit.
You get points when you grocery shop for fuel.
Sanchez says she would get gas at Costco, but nowadays the line is just way too long. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
It is indeed. So that was the story of what we're buying and how much of it we're buying. Now, what it's like to be the person selling. We get March retail sales on Thursday. In other words, how much inflation might be weighing on consumer demand. So we've called our usual trio of small businesses to see what's what price and inflation-wise. First up, Kristen Tullheimer-Bingham, co-owner of Dean's Sweets up in Portland, Maine.
Our costs are rising for sure. The cost of cocoa has gone up. Prices for shipping have gone up. One of our sugar suppliers recently added a fee, probably due to gas prices, we think. When something like chocolate or cocoa is available, instead of buying 5 cases, for example, we'll order 50. Our prices haven't changed. It's a calculation, of course. We can't read our customers' minds, but we do have a feel for the price point that we think they're comfortable being in. So that's really why we haven't increased our prices.
Kristen Tullheimer-Bingham, Portland, Maine is where she is. Two more of our retailers to come. Also on the way, the sad music when we do the numbers. These are not good days to be in Shanghai. The city of 25 million or so people, and not for nothing, the center of finance in the second biggest economy on the planet, is in the middle of a so far indefinite lockdown to control a COVID outbreak. Shanghai accounts for about 95% of all the cases currently in China. The U.S. State Department has had enough. Yesterday, it ordered non-emergency employees of the American consulate in Shanghai and their families to leave. They are coming home on commercial flights, but not everybody is getting out. Among them, our Jennifer Pack.
Throughout most of the pandemic, I could order in Shanghai a fresh lobster, have it cleaned and delivered to my doorstep within 30 minutes. Last week, I cycled through a dozen grocery apps before 6 a.m. to order basics like eggs. No luck. Since April 1st, Shanghai has effectively locked down the entire city. Certain parts have been under lockdown even longer. A taxi driver tells me before the lockdown, he took a passenger who was allowed out only to refill her medication. He says her compound had been sealed since mid-March, even though it had no COVID-19 cases. He swears, then says these pandemic rules are just ridiculous. During this lockdown, residents are not allowed to step past their front doors except for mass testings, which are done in batches of 20.
So I just got a call. Out of the 20 people in the same tube, someone within that 20 has COVID.
Next day, I do a retest. If I catch COVID, Shanghai authorities will take me, my contacts, and their contacts to isolation facilities that aren't always that clean. A medical staff swabs so far down my throat and up my nose, I protest. PCRs here are rough. I tested negative, which is lucky. Shanghai's medical system is so overwhelmed that some people have been sent to other provinces, majority with mild to no symptoms. These people should be allowed to isolate at home, says a Shanghai CDC official in a call with a COVID patient's son.
Yeah, we are being driven crazy as a professionals. When we speak, no one listens. The virus has become politicized.
The call was leaked and went viral across WeChat groups. What's riled people up even more, videos of supposed COVID-positive children, several to a crib, seemingly unattended. We can't verify the videos, but last week at a press conference, the Shanghai Health Commission's Wu Tianyu admitted it was policy to isolate COVID-positive children from parents.
Those infected with COVID should be separated from those who are not.
More public outcry until officials back down slightly and say children who catch COVID won't be separated from parents in some cases. No such guarantees for pets who are feared to be virus spreaders. In WeChat groups, friends circulate a video of a corgi being beaten to death by a person in a hazmat suit. The pet owner had reportedly tested positive for COVID. One friend writes, "If anyone touches my dogs, I'll grab a cleaver." Perhaps the biggest worry is food. The only thing that seems to work are group buys, but they're time-consuming. Anyone want to split 29 pounds of bananas? There are district government handouts. I've received frozen shrimp and a few veggies, but over at Marketplace's news assistant Charles Zhang's, his vegetable handouts took nearly 2 weeks to arrive, and he only got a turnip, one cabbage, a bit of Chinese veg, plus two potatoes. And he's got 8 mouths to feed in his extended family. Friends have forwarded countless protest videos. People say they're going hungry. They need to work. Censors delete these videos as fast as they can. Instead, you can read the Shanghai CDC's tutorial on how to grow your own bean sprouts. At least one guy has succeeded and showed off in a video. He says he was trying for 2 weeks before he grew sprouts from mung beans, something I also can't seem to buy these days. In Shanghai, from China's wealthiest city, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
The consumer price index we got this morning comes in a variety of flavors, the national number, which we told you about, and then regional data, too. And for the West region, which the Bureau of Labor Statistics says includes California, Hawaii, and New Mexico, among others, inflation was even higher than the national number, 8.7% for the year ending in March. So we got Micah Fatah on the line. She owns Sunshine Alchemists and Soap Company in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which does, yes, make and sell soaps, but candles and lotions too.
Costs on every single item have increased. Shipping, labels, even like the toner for the printer. And so unfortunately, we did have to increase our prices. There was no way to avoid it. What I watch more than the prices, ordering the things that we need far, far in advance, because absolutely necessary things like wicks. There was a huge wick shortage, and you can't make candles without wicks. So just projecting and always like making sure that you don't run out of a critical item.
Gotta have wicks for your candles. Micah Fatah, she's in Albuquerque. Coming up.
Everybody is scrambling to buy.
Hey, let's be safe out there, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials down 87 points, about a quarter percent, 34,220. The NASDAQ down 40, about 0.3%, 13,371. S&P 500 lost 15 points, 0.3%, 43.97. Been hearing from some small retailers throughout the show about how they're managing inflation. So let's look at some big retailers, shall we? Gap down 1.5% today. Ulta Beauty gained 0.5%. Wayfair dropped about 5.4% today. Matt Levin was telling us about people buying in bulk. So, bulk store stocks. How about that? Try saying that 10 times fast, by the way. Costco gave up about 0.5% today. Walmart, which owns Sam's Club, sank 0.7%. Bond prices went up. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note thus went down 2.72%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The geopolitical calculations that are going on right now in Europe. How much pain the 27 members of the European Union are willing to take in order to impose maximum pain on Russia, which is the whole point of these sanctions, right? Those geopolitics might be better called, in this instance, geoeconomics. Because the Europeans have banned Russian coal, not yet Russian oil and natural gas, even though that's where the money is. Reluctance that is easy to explain given how reliant some EU countries are on it, Germany specifically. The policy rationale behind letting that dependence develop was called change through trade. That doing business with countries like Russia would promote freedom and democracy over there. So how's that working out so far, huh? Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from the European desk.
German lawmakers applauded when President Zelensky of Ukraine addressed them by video link a few weeks ago, but he berated them. He said they'd ignored the warnings about Germany becoming dependent on cheap Russian gas for one fundamental reason. Germany had put its own economic interests ahead of everything else, he suggested. That's not the way many German businesses and governments in the past would have put it. They said they were operating under the lofty notion that
economic exchange will help to build a peaceful world.
Ralph Bollmann, a political biographer, says that for several decades, Germany subscribed enthusiastically to the idea of change through trade, that trading with autocracies would not only be good for business,
that economic growth, wealth, will directly lead to more democracy, more freedom.
Putin's invasion of Ukraine has left that thesis in tatters. But, says Yanis Kluger of the SWP think tank, change through trade has long been a convenient, self-serving, and, as it turns out, dangerous idea.
Germany intensified its business relations with Russia, although there was no sign at all that this would lead to any positive change in Russia, and in the end, it might have even emboldened Putin to do what he is doing right now in Ukraine.
It certainly helped him to pay for the invasion, he says.
These tanks that are rolling into Ukraine, to a large degree, have been financed by our energy revenue, the money that we sent to Moscow in the last years. And this, of course, is, I mean, it's painful. It's a rude awakening.
Also painful, says Tim Rulich of the German Council on Foreign Relations, is the dawning realization that thanks to the change through trade policy, Germany has become dependent on some very autocratic regimes.
And those dependencies may limit the foreign policy choices we have, the political room to maneuver.
Germany's reliance on Russia for more than half its natural gas explains why the country has resisted the calls for immediate sanctions on all Russian energy. And could Germany's failure to denounce some of China's alleged human rights abuses be linked to this statistic?
Around a third of German car makers' sales are being made in China. That is, of course, enormous.
It's even bigger for Germany's biggest automaker. Volkswagen runs more than 30 factories in China, like this one in Foshan. And the company derives more than 40% of its global sales and profits from that country.
You get a rough understanding how over-dependent we are on China at the moment.
The move to wean Germany very gradually off Russian gas is underway, but calls for a reduction in exports to China have met resistance in the business community. Volker Trier is with the German Chambers of Commerce.
There is no reason to reduce trade to lose a market which is huge, which is still growing.
The Germans' urge to trade is pretty overwhelming. Exports account for almost half their economy. But now they can no longer claim, when trading with autocrats, that they're promoting freedom and democracy. At the European desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Pacific Gas and Electric, one of the biggest and most troubled utilities in California, has agreed to pay north of $50 million in connection with two major wildfires sparked by its equipment. One of those fires, last year's Dixie Fire, was the biggest in California's long history of wildfires and the country's most expensive. The settlement money goes toward fire prevention, but it's also raising some questions, given PG&E's recent, shall we say, legal troubles. Because in exchange for the money, the company is getting out from under criminal charges for fires that state investigators have already decided were its fault. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has that story.
William Abrams and his family lost their home almost 5 years ago in a wildfire in Northern California's Sonoma County. He's upset about this week's deal, which protects PG&E from facing charges for one major wildfire and dismisses them in another.
They decided to settle rather than press charges, and that's no way to pursue justice.
The deal calls for PG&E to hire more line inspectors and tree trimmers and to fund an independent safety monitor.
What we felt was this was a better mechanism for accountability.
Jill Ravitch, the district attorney of Sonoma County, says this deal was the best she and other small county prosecutors could get. She says they asked for help from Rob Bonta, California's attorney general, but says he declined.
The attorney general could step forward and could take these cases on a statewide basis. The attorney general's office has many, many more resources than we do at the county level.
In a statement, the attorney general's office denied ever getting a request for help from Ravitch. Steve Weissman teaches utility regulation at Berkeley's Goldman School of Public Policy. He says that even if criminal charges had been pursued, accountability is tough to achieve when PG&E has so much turnaround at the top.
Past officers are gone. No one goes to prison. So it's not immediately clear that this is going to be something that is going to spur dramatic improvement within the company.
Weissman notes charges in these cases are still worth pursuing, and PG&E does face the prospect of four more for manslaughter in another major fire. That case is also being litigated by county prosecutors, not the attorney general. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
One last data point from this morning's inflation reading, 5%. That's how much the price index for shelter went up for the 12 months ended in March, a nearly 31-year high. And that brings me to Cynthia Cummins. She's a real estate agent and the owner of Kindred SF Homes in San Francisco.
I can barely keep up with what's going on in the real estate market in San Francisco right now. Everybody is scrambling to buy while interest rates aren't too high, and they're also scrambling to get their properties on the market. It's so expensive in San Francisco, and it's talked about so much that everybody kind of knows it. So when you start the buying process, I always feel a little sad when somebody says, well, I can spend up to $1.8 million, and if I could please just have two bedrooms on the same level. And you would think that you could get that for that kind of money. So San Francisco is surreal. It's surreal estate, really.
Insane real estate, more like. Cynthia Cummins in San Francisco. This inflation final note on the way out today, an update on the shipping backlog at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach that we've been keeping an eye on, where the number of container ships stuck waiting to unload has been slowly but steadily going down. 45 at COB yesterday, up one from Friday, way down, though, from the record 109 back in early January. We'll be right back. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context, because context matters. Hello. Lots of inflation on the program today, as there should have been, I think, because it's a big deal, 8.5%. Also a big deal, though, an unemployment rate of 3.6%, darn near 50-year lows. Context matters, people. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.